This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebounding Safety. Today we're talking to a very prominent voice in the safety space, particularly if you're in the new view, old view kind of debate, the one and only Dr. Rob Long.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution or one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviours.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Blue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit that subscribe button, bell, follow, share, whatever button it is that does something magical on the algorithm. Today we're talking to the amazing, the legendary, the controversial Rob Long. He's got lots to say and had very good chat actually. Really, really enjoyed it, even though a lot of the stuff is quite provocative. And hey, aren't we all sometimes? So it was a really good chat. I was a little bit nervous about this one, but actually I really enjoyed this chat. And I'm looking forward to you all hearing it, looking forward to you all listening and getting your feedback. And I'm looking forward to seeing what you say. What do you think about it? Before we do that though, it's a quick message from Paradigm Human Performance HSE subscription service, the sponsors of Rebranding Safety podcast and YouTube channel. Their HSE subscription service is not your everyday off-the-shelf compliance system. Paradigm are human performance experts. So this is a system that puts worker safety at the DNA, but it also builds you that strong foundation of compliance. It ticks those boxes, regulatory and industry compliance. This is a system that's going to have HOP woven throughout it. So you're not going to have to come back to this in a couple of years and declutter it. It's a perfect solution for those small, medium-sized enterprises that are just juggling balls all the time. Sometimes safety falls by the wayside. If this sounds like the right solution for you, give them a call on the phone number in the description below or drop them an email using the email in the description below as well. If you're still not sure, you can go to their website, find out some more about them, sign up to the Learning Organization webinar on their website as well, which is an outstanding resource. Just an amazing team of people. I absolutely love what they do. I'm involved in so much of what they do. They're an outstanding company. Teresa, the flagship, the leader, the founder of that organization, is an amazing person. So thank you very much, Paradigm, for partnering with us and letting us tell our listeners about the amazing work that you guys are doing. Without further ado, let's jump into today's episode with the amazing Dr. Rob Long.
Right, Rob, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on. Why don't you, for those that might not know you, just give yourself an introduction? And then we'll get into a chat from there.
Okay. Well, my name's Robert Long. I live in Australia in a place called Canberra, which is the capital. Most people know Sydney and Melbourne, but Canberra is halfway between each city. I've lived here for quite some time and I've had numerous careers over my life. I'm now nearly 68 and in the process of kind of retiring. Although the demands are quite strong, I'm kind of handing over to other people who I've mentored over a long period of time. I run three companies. I have a training company called Human Dimensions. I have a academic company called the Center for Leadership and Learning and Risk. And I'm the founder of a discipline of social psychology called the Social Psychology of Risk. And so... apart from that, I'm a husband to my wife, Helen, over 48 years. I have four of my own children and five grandchildren. And in my retirement time, those kinds of things are keeping me fairly busy. And then most of the time now I'm either coaching or Zooming or whatever. But since COVID, I've stopped all face-to-face stuff. And that's kind of worked out fine because I've got lots of other people who I've mentored who are actually doing face-to-face stuff throughout Australia. So yeah, that might be an introduction enough, unless you want to know about websites or books I've written or things like that. But you can search me online. I'm easy to find if you search online.
And at the end as well, we'll give you an opportunity to kind of shout out to stuff like that. So if people want to find you, we'll talk about that stuff.
They'll find it.
How have you been through COVID? Have you survived it pretty well, hopefully?
Well, Australia is quite unique, not just because it's an island, but because initially with COVID about a year and a half ago, the country shut down and we kept COVID out. But then lots of expat Australians wanted to return, and that proved very problematic because we don't have enough quarantine facilities. We only have one in the middle of nowhere that takes about 2,000 people at a time, and there's something like 60,000 Australians want to come home for some reason. I've got no idea. And when they come home, they bring COVID with them. So we have all these outbreaks and lockdowns. But at the moment, by and large, the country is COVID-free, and we get little breakouts and then we lock down and everyone's back at home. But nothing like in the UK. We don't have anything like, 50,000 cases a day or whatever you guys are getting there. So it's a completely different culture, I guess, and a completely different circumstance. And I have no idea where it's going to go, but everyone's trying to get madly vaccinated at the moment.
Yeah.
We're
more kind of dealing with this. Are we dealing with it? I think most people are just kind of getting vaccinated, but I think there's an ever-growing argument around the vaccine, more than what I've ever seen before, which is interesting. And now we've got this unique kind of, is it a moral dilemma? Maybe like a moral dilemma in that companies talking about the vaccine and what we should do as a company with the vaccine, which is really a discussion I don't think anyone ever expected to have in the workplace.
Well, we've got the same here, and the idea of mandating a vaccine for employment or a vaccine for travel, I can't see that being very far away. Mm. Maybe here it'll only be a couple of months. And I think despite the protests, I think the idea of a mandated vaccine will probably come about in certain circumstances. Because even when we have have such a light pressure of COVID here, our hospitals at the moment are under complete stress. The medical system is completely stressed, and it adds enormous pressure to the economy. So I think there'll be economic arguments. Yeah. Whether they're moral arguments, I don't know. But there's a small fringe of people who kind of crusade on the, my right to choice thing and all that sort of stuff. But I don't know where it will go. I think it'll be mandated in the end.
Yeah, we're kind of on a bit of a half-assed approach. Let employers kind of make the decision for themselves. And in some cases, the government have taken over. And then in some cases, it's kind of, you can't go to a club. Not that I'm going to clubs, if I'm honest, but like you can't go to a club and stuff like that. It's interesting.
Well, it's something not likely.
I'd discuss.
Well, it puts Tory governments in particular tension because the Tory ideology over its history has been resistant to that kind of thing and very much, trying to laissez-faire economics. But you can't practice laissez-faire economics in this current condition. So it'd be interesting to see where it goes. I mean, we've got a Tory government at the moment here in Australia, and they're getting absolutely hammered. They're just getting belted everywhere. So it'll be interesting to see whether even Boris Johnson can maintain his popularity over the time or not. Only time will tell.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's if you like studying ideologies and how they work out practically, there are lots to look at.
I bet. Yeah, next general election will be very interesting there, and not like we've had boring general elections for the last couple of years.
It depends how capable the opposition is and how well they can articulate their position They haven't done well in the past anyway, so...
No, that's something they've lacked at for a long time.
Well, not in your country anyway, so...
No.
Who knows? Who knows, James? Who knows?
Yeah. Right, mate, let's get into it. I think today we were going to have a chat around kind of semiotics and how we use that within safety correctly or incorrectly from your point of view. So, but to start off with, for those that may not know what that is, do you want to give us an introduction as to what semiotics actually is?
Yeah, well, I could. I've actually got a couple of slides I could put on the screen if you want to share the screen and I could speak to that because it gives good context.
You can just bear in mind that some people will listen to this without the visual, so I can
fine.
So just make sure that
you for those who do you want me to share the screen so you can have a look?
You should be able to now, mate.
Okay, let's have a look. Okay, so when I normally do studies in semiotics, I try to give it context so people can understand where it sits. Mm-hmm. And of course the best way to explain semiotics is to explain it semiotically. So the concept of a map is a very good semiotic concept, like concept mapping. And so if you look at the social sciences in general, you put semiotics there on a strand of its own, somewhere between... sociology and psychology, but a lot of people don't know about semiotics as a school of thought, and so in many ways it's an unknown, particularly for the sciences. So in Australia, if you study safety, you don't go into the social sciences; you actually go into a faculty of science or a faculty of health. So in Australia, you don't find any work health safety qualifications situated within any of these schools of thought, which of course means that most of these schools of thought you're looking on the screen, like anthropology, economics, ethnic studies, ethnography, geography, history, linguistics, political science, sociology, and all the branches of psychology, you find them not really covered at all in the risk and safety world, it's more of a mechanical world, a measurement world, an engineering science world.
Definitely.
It doesn't mean that that's wrong. It just means that safety over its history, short 60-year history, has been quite narrowly framed so that many of these schools of thought that you're looking at here get no, they just don't get any focus at all within the risk and safety world. So if you have a look at this next slide, these are all the schools of semiotics within semiotics. So there are about 36 different schools of thought within semiotics. Just like there are, you know, maybe 250 schools of psychology within psychology, or, you know, 36 schools of sociology within sociology. So when I map the size of the concept of semiotics, which is the study of sign symbol systems, when you start to map it, you start to realize how big it is. And the biggest schools that exist in Estonia, in Tallinn, in Estonia, and in Chicago in the United States. But interestingly, in Australia, there is not one school of semiotics in any of our universities here. So it gives you an interesting overview of where semiotics sits. Given that safety and risk is very much presenting itself in visual ways and trying to market itself in various ways, I find it rather remarkable that the industry is very much ignorant about semiotics or semiosis or the semiosphere or any of these disciplines that actually exist. And when I throw out the possibility to people of, look, would you like to find out about these things? Most risk and safety people poo-hoo it and, you know, this is silly or this is off at a tangent or, you know, let's just get back to counting or mechanics or counting LTIs or whatever you're doing. And yet I don't think you can divorce the study of semiotics from any discipline that seeks to visualize or symbolize what it does. So that gives you a bit of a context to it. There are other maps I do when I study with my students. So within the study of semiotics, this is another map that can map for you just the incredible visual world we have. And there are three strands of semiotics that are quite obvious. There's semiotics in the natural life. So biosemiotics, for example, studying anything. So a tree, in a sense, is a symbol. A kangaroo can be a symbol. So you have zoo semiotics, phytosemiotics, and anthroposemiotics, which is a touch to humans. But then we have artificial life semiotics, and so much of our movies and our TV shows are very much around artificial life and supernatural life. So Star Wars, Terminator, Buffy, any of the popular, most popular movies of all time. In fact, I think the 20 most popular movies of all time are about artificial life and supernatural life. So semiotics tends to study these things in popular culture, such as supernatural semiotics in movies. So Harry Potter, The Matrix, and so on. All of this stuff shows that there's a huge thirst in popular culture for these things. And yet in the risk and safety world, it doesn't even get a mention. So that does that give you, I'll just switch the sharing off. Does that give you a bit of an overview of semiotics, just how big it is?
I mean, yeah, definitely. I think that for me, Rob, that's one of the issues is that, I mean, you mentioned that there's no appetite from safety.
And no.
I think from my point of view, there's a growing appetite. I think maybe there's not enough, but there's definitely a growing appetite for looking at psychology, sociology, and stuff like that. Granted, semiotics has only just started to come up in the conversations. From my experience and my crowd and my engagement, I think there is an appetite. I think it's growing, but it's slow. But I think one of the issues, Rob, is just the sheer vastity, the sheer scale of how much there is to learn. And I think when you touched on correctly, and I agree in that, you know, safety professionals are kind of doomed to fail prior to even getting started. All of our educational routes into a very engineering base, they're not even engineering based. They're very basic. They're very read this guide and then go tell everybody this is what the guide says.
Yeah.
So we're kind of, I kind of feel like, Rob, it's not really the safety profession's fault or the safety professionals' fault. I feel like we don't communicate to people studying psychology or sociology or any of those kind of practices that this is a viable career choice.
Well, I call it compulsory miseducation because there has been opportunity over time, but the market's kind of been closed by the associations like IOSH and in Australia, the Institute of Health and Safety. And it's very much been closed. I mean, I called for reforming the curriculum 10 years ago in Australia, and there's been no thirst to even look at the very myopic view that people are educated. So you get to the basic safety degree and the safety diploma we have here in Australia. And most people trained in safety, when they leave their university or their training institution, don't even know the very, very basic fundamentals of communication. Simple things like listening and conversation, observing, engaging with others in a way that can get constructive outcomes, understanding simple things like motivation, goal setting, and the psychology of motivation and what makes people tick. All of these things are excluded. All of them are excluded from the safety curriculum. And yet the moment a safety person gets out on site, that's all they want to know. Motivation, what makes people tick? Why do they make decisions like they make decisions like they do? Not all this silly, oh, he's just an idiot and all this dismissive stuff. All of that stuff is missing. And if safety was ever seriously about cultivating capable safety professionals, they would have to move away from what they're currently doing. Because at the moment, I can't see anything professional being regurgitated out of the institutions. I mean, I've worked in six professions in my life. I'm not a young person. I worked in six, and I would never compare safety to school teaching, social work, community services, the public service, the legal profession, the medical profession. I wouldn't even compare them. You cannot compare the education of a nurse, and I have a daughter who's a nurse, and I have a daughter who's a teacher. You could not compare them to a safety person and use the same word profession. There's just no comparison. So I don't use the word, and I don't encourage the use of the word, because I think until safety changes its focus and moves away from counting and mechanics and all that kind of quantitative stuff, unless it moves away from that, it's not going to move into becoming a helping profession, which of course most professions identify themselves as a profession of helping. But if you look at any of the literature around safety identifying as a professional, it never uses the words care or helping. It never uses the words about caring and helping humans. And without that kind of language, it just becomes more of a, I think it's quite an amateurish pastime, and it prepares its people very poorly, so that when you finally get out on site, the first thing people scream to me is, Rob, help me to connect with people better. Help me to be an articulate conversant. Help me to be a good listener. Help me to start to communicate, because I'm not being effective and everyone thinks I'm a pain in the ass because I just roll out and tell them what the regulation says and they don't want to know. And so I for the last 20 years, my business has gone absolutely gangbusters, because the industry, and this is not the fault of people, people have no choice. They have to enroll in a diploma or enroll in a degree that teaches them all the wrong things about what you do when you engage with people. You can't roll up on a building site and tell some plumber that he's doing something wrong because you know something about the regulation and you've never been a plumber before. And then the moment something goes wrong in Australia, they boot the safety person out and they bring in a lawyer who actually does know the act and regulation, and the safety person completely disappears. So whatever they've learned about regulation and legislation is not used anyway if there's a crisis. It's only used on this kind of temporary day-to-day basis. And most of the, I mean, you know, if you get on a building and construction site in Australia and a safety person rolls on site, they usually use swear words to describe what they think of them. I don't know if it's like that in the UK, but it's not perceived as a help. You're not here to help me. You're here to annoy me. You're here to tell me off or you, whatever. And so for many of those reasons and more, I get very frustrated with an industry that seems locked into this kind of terrible narrative that safety is about telling people what to do. It's more policeman like than it is helping like.
I agree with everything you've said, and I think in England we have very much the same problem. I would, however, say there is a growing contingent of people trying to stop that. And I think there's a massive movement to this more, for lack of a better phrase, the softer skills, which it's a huge growing contingent for that. But also I will kind of back up your point in that, and I can only talk for England. I haven't worked around the world. So the bodies, the large bodies that either represent our profession or they represent our qualification routes have little to no appetite to even make some serious change. And I think we're starting to see a lot of pressure come on them. You know, there's a lot of people leaving them, a lot of people going over to to different professions. You know, you're seeing a bit of a shift to safety professionals. I know you don't like the phrase, but we'll use that for a conversation's sake. You know, moving over to bodies like the Chartered Institute of Ergonomics and Human Factors because they're realizing that's where they want to go or whatever. Ultimately, Rob, like, you don't speak very kindly of the kind of new view safety movement either, which has all of that stuff that you've said. Like, it talks about care. It talks about, you know, psychology and sociology.
Not much.
Really?
No, not much at all. Now, have a look at what they... Well, you know,
they look like the safety differently movement, for example. Safety differently is all about, like, ethical responsibility, care, you know, like, all of that stuff.
They never... Isn't it interesting? So I find it interesting that you'll find nowhere in the safety differently movement at all a study of ethics or any serious addressing of ethics outside of using the word.
Yeah, there's a significant lack of philosophy. I'll agree with you on that. There's a significant lack.
Okay, so there is this naive clutching to a few slogans, and if you scratch beneath the slogans, there's nothing that's different. There is no unique methodology to it. And I find it quite impoverished in the way it's tried to move away from traditional safety. So if you move over and you use the slogan of safety differently, I would suggest you need to do something that's different. And apart from having a few slogans and seeking to reduce clutter, I can't see a great deal of significant methodology within what they do, because what they drift mostly back to is systems. They advocate the use of better systems. They don't talk about moving away from the idea of putting all of our faith in excessive systems. They just talk about, well, our systems are different than the other systems. And I've done quite a good analysis of the different kinds of things that are thrown forward as better systems, and they're the same. It's the same stuff. Right. So one of the reasons I'm not so kind to the Safety Differently group is I think if you scratch below the surface to serious matters like putting forward an ethic of risk, it's not there. And again, if you look at the language, for example, if you jump on the Safety Differently website and look at some of the blogs that they've put up, man oh man alive, it's all about quantitative safety. It's still the same. And so unless there is a significant shift away to embrace some of these other disciplines, which I would call a transdisciplinary approach, unless there's a move away from that same old engineering science stuff, and of course look at the Safety Differently thing, it anchors itself to science yet again. We're still anchored to this quantitative language about risk, then it's not going to move very much. So I can't see it. I'd like to argue, and I've got friends in the Safety Differently movement, Jeff Lith in Vancouver, I've visited numerous times. He's got some link of me up on the Safety Differently website. He sees me as kind of part of that group. I have no connection to Sydney Decker. I have no connection to Eric Holnagel. I have no connection to any of the so-called people or gurus in that movement. I have none, never have. I've tried to make connections to them, but they don't want a connection to me. And I could tell you numerous stories about that. So
ultimately, though, Rob, like Eric Honag is a psychologist, as far as I'm aware. His background is psychology.
Yeah, not like mine. No, it's a he is very. See, you can talk. A behaviorist is a psychologist.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a school of thought I've got 3 seconds for.
Right.
I'm not an object. I'm not the sum of inputs and outputs. And if you want to go down that pathway, you're welcome to it, but it doesn't humanize people. So unless your area of psychology seeks to humanize people, and so you end up with human factors and organizational psychology still focused on systems. It's such a funny thing, isn't it? You study human factors, but you don't study humans. If you study human factors, it's a study of systems, not humans.
So what's the difference between that and what you do then?
Well,
what do you study, if that makes sense?
Okay, well, social psychology is a branch of psychology that puts the social reality of humans as the foundation. So you and I are right now in a social relationship. Whether you like it or not, here you are, here I am, and there's a space between us. Whether we agree or not is not important.
Yeah.
What is happening at the moment is there is a dialectic between you and me. There's a space between you and me of several thousand kilometers. And social psychology is very interested in that space, that dialogue between you and us, because what happens in that space makes you and I who we are. So you probably identify as a son, as a brother, you identify as a mate or a friend, and all of those are social words for how we fundamentally identify ourselves.
Yep.
So human beings are fundamentally not an object, an individual object. We are social beings. And so social psychology starts from that base, that the very foundation of your existence and your being came out of someone else. You have a mother, you have a father. Even if your mother and father are in a test tube, you still have an origin in another human being, whether it was their sperm or their ova. And so in social psychology, we look at, we start with social being and we move from there out. We don't start with humans as the individual. In fact, we say there's no such thing as an individual. There's no I, there's only I, thou. And that foundation point instantly makes a difference to where you go to next. Okay. If you're a behaviorist or you're an organizational psychologist or an institutional psychologist, like quite a number in the Safety Differently group are, you don't end out moving away from this idea that systems serve me. What the story you get in the Safety Differently group and you get within organizational psychology groups is humans serve systems. And I throw that the other way around. We create systems to serve us. If our systems don't enhance personhood, humanity, and social being, then get rid of the system, because it's not helping you ethically to be a person. And so I don't serve systems. Systems are created to serve us as people. And I know it's a slight change, but it makes a huge difference to what the trajectory of the philosophy is. And so that's where we come from. And of course, semiotics or signed symbol systems sit within that. Unless a symbol conveys something for us to enable us, to humanize us, then the system is not working. So you get rid of it. And especially if something dehumanizes people, which safety seems to be awfully good at, is you get rid of it. If the system, like let's say a zero system, a system that's based on zero brutalizes human beings to get its outcome of zero, then it's not an ethical system. It's a crap system. Dump it. And so that's the difference in between. And there are lots of schools of psychology, lots, but social psychology is one of them. It's got about a social psychology has been around for 80 years, and lots of people like behavioral economists like Kahneman touch on it slightly. Quite a number of the people in the Safety Differently group touch on it slightly. But in the end, if you look at the linguistics of the Safety Differently group, the difference is just marginal. There is a difference, but it's marginal. And from my perspective, if you've got an opportunity to go in a better margin, then go for it. So that's what I do. I tend not to enter into too much debate with the group because I've tried in the past and they're not interested in a debate. So it doesn't happen.
Do you think that, I mean, from my non-academic point of view, Rob, I think a lot of us practitioners get a bit fed up of all of these academics just arguing with each other.
Well, I'm not arguing with them. Yeah, but I understand practitioners would get sick of it because...
We don't know where to look, mate. We don't know where to look because one says psychology, the other says social science.
Well, in Australia, most of the practitioners here would just call it a wank. That's what Aussies would call it. I don't know if Pommies would call it a wank, but we would. And so I tend not to work too hard in that space. So I deliberately have kept out of academia. Like I have written books which are not published outside. They're published outside of the academic field. I write blogs. I don't write academic papers. So you won't find me anywhere in the Journal of Safety Science or any of that sort of stuff. I helped co-write one article with Sidney Decker because he doesn't know theology. And I guess I was a foil for a paper he wanted to write about zero as a religion. But other than that, I'm not really in the academic field. And most of what I do is incredibly practical. It works. It's practical. It's very, very down to earth. I've created heaps of practical methods that help you undertake the job of safety on site. And most of the work I do, you can read about the people who do my work. It works. It's extremely practical. I'm not around there. They're trying to particularly... win business or anything like that. I don't have to. It's like I'm running a workshop coming up in September, and I've got 50 people from Brazil have enrolled for the workshop. I don't know what it is about Brazilians, but they sure like the particular methods that I articulate.
Yeah. You mentioned your blog and you mentioned communication a few times. Like the method of communication that you choose to use in your blog, Rob, is really aggressive.
It's critical. It's not aggressive.
It's what? Sorry.
Well, it's your choice of words. It's critical. It's not aggressive.
Okay.
Well, I never insult a person.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
There's no direct. There's no direct attack on a person. I never have written ever. In fact, I usually personify the word safety as an archetype, which is a Jungian thing. And so I often talk about safety, what safety does. Mm. And it's a general archetypical method which tends to generalize, but there's plenty of evidence for it, which tends to generalize things. Like, say, for example, if I was to talk about the safety curriculum, I could say this is what safety does. Yeah. And you would be struggling to find an exception to that rule, struggling, yeah. Even globally. And so I have friends in the legal profession who rather scoffingly talk about the safety industry and its astounding ignorance, which is what my legal friends would say, because one of the first things they do when someone gets killed on site or something like that, the first thing they do is they usually get the safety person and send them on holiday, because they're an absolute embuggerance to the process of understanding the law. So it's one thing to offer criticism. It's another thing to, I think, attack people personally and or by name. I rarely do that. I mostly talk about the industry. And it is an industry. It's not a profession. It's very industrious. Most of the people are out there touting safety stuff, making money out of it. It's about making money. It's not necessarily about
money. Does make the world go round, though. I mean, money's part of it.
Yeah, sure, but it's not about Sure, but it's not about making safety better.
So you mean it's kind of profit over impact? Oh, I suppose. Yeah.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
Is there any other thing?
I'm inclined to agree with that. Do you not think, though, like sometimes, Rob, because I think sometimes it's very similar to actually Dom Cooper, whether you get on with Dom or not, I don't know. But
no.
I think,
no.
I'm not surprised. No. I think
it's behaviours.
I do think that both have kind of similar kind of communication methods, very critical. You know, challenge a lot of stuff, and they're openly critical. But ultimately, I think, Rob, like that gets kind of that overly kind of what I would say aggressive or critical nature kind of drowns out the value of what you're saying. So, like you say, for example, like you don't personally attack someone, which I get, and I can tell you're not a nasty guy. I can tell you're doing this for all the right reasons. But from my point of view, when I look at it, say that blog you wrote about Semiotics the other day, you referenced my brand. My brand is personal to me. So being critical of that brand is indirectly being critical of me. And I have seen blogs where you've done similar for you know, Decker or Cooper, you know. So my point here, Rob, is that as a practitioner, when I read it, I'm just like, this is just another piece of writing that's just angry at another piece of writing. And I struggle to walk away with something that actually helps me. So I wonder whether a lot more, if those, you know, those thought leaders, people like yourself, you know, were a little bit less like about attacking each other's ideas and more about, like to your point, actually just helping people do some work, we might get further a bit or a bit more forward, okay, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I understand that. But the things that I do that are critical are balanced out by at least 2-1 of solutions which are incredibly practical. So I don't just say, look at this, this doesn't work. Yeah. I say, okay, yes, that's right, this doesn't work. And what's astounding is you all know it doesn't work, which is astounding. And then when I criticize that it doesn't work, everyone starts defending, even though they know that paperwork doesn't work. Then they criticize me for criticizing paperwork. But then at the same time, I propose heaps of practical solutions about what does work. Yeah. So it's not empty criticism. It's researched, founded criticism that has plenty of evidence for it. And so if you were looking for a positive, constructive alternative, I offer that. It's not just criticism for its own sake. For example, from all the studies I've done in semiotics, surely if you wanted to choose an effective semiotic that could penetrate the unconscious and heavily influence a group you were trying to influence, surely you would investigate the power of semiotics and what it could do and do better. It could be offered to you and say, look, in a way, This is not as effective as this could be. Are you interested?
Yeah.
Now, if you can't do that without criticism, and one of the weaknesses of the risk and safety industry is it has not been cultivated over time to accept criticism, because another weakness of the industry is it's based completely on compliance. Agree with me. I know the law and the regulation. I just walked on site. I told you that's in the wrong place. I told you to fix it. Now comply.
Yeah, I know better.
Of course, I know better. Don't contest my view.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
So the policing compliance thing is kind of in the DNA of safety. So when someone comes along and says to you, look, and I understand Dom's point of view. I understand behaviorism. I get it. I don't agree with him, though. There's a long history of behaviorism within the safety industry that demonstrates that it doesn't work. There's just huge amounts to show that behavior-based safety has had its day, and it often leads into that kind of brutalistic activity where you treat a person as a behavioral object.
Yeah.
And I'm not interested in that. Dom can have it if he likes, and he can probably make good money out of it if he likes. But again, unless it has a social, ethical value, and unless you can show me that it respects persons and doesn't dehumanize persons, then I'll go with you. But if it doesn't do those things, I'm not interested. We've got a whole industry who's sick to death of being bullied by a safety officer.
Mm.
Everyone's sick of that. So
I agree.
Where do we go next? So I'm happy to be critical of behaviorism, and I am, but I don't just leave it there. Here's an option. I'm not proposing empty criticism. I offer constructive stuff. So for example, the latest book I wrote, it works. It's a whole book on how a large international company called Mondi Group in Europe, huge company, it's one of the biggest international companies, how they have moved away from zero. They've totally dumped it, including their board of management and executives. It's taken them 2 years, totally dumped it, and now they do what works. They actually do practical things that work, that don't demonize people, that actually help people. Now, so the criticism's not shallow. There are organizations who are doing it, and they're getting the results, practical results from it.
Yeah.
So yeah, you could say that I stir people up. Yeah. You could call that aggressive if you like.
I don't think there's any problem with being critical. I don't think there's any. I actually welcome people stirring this profession up, because I actually agree with probably 90% of your criticisms of our profession. I agree with everything you said. But what I do see, Rob, from my opinion, is I think there's a bit of a lack of maybe a lack of charity to the fact that we're not educated as social psychologists or philosophers or anything. So to us, it's like, yeah, I agree with everything you're saying, but we don't have the answer. So for example, you said about what, surely you would look into semiotics when you're kind of creating a symbol or something like that. Well, surely you would, but put yourself in my shoes of someone who's got zero, you know, scientific, psychological, sociology kind of background. Mate, it wasn't until a couple of months ago I even knew what semiotics was. So no, I wouldn't have looked into it.
Sure, but like all people, you go, if you need something medically, you go to a general practitioner or to a surgeon. You go, if you don't know something, you go to it. It's only in the safety industry that you don't.
Mm. Okay.
You don't look, if you've got a pain in your chest this afternoon, you're gonna fix it yourself, or you're gonna call the doctor or the hospital or whatever.
Yeah.
So
you're saying we don't consult with people that know about it?
Of course we don't.
Yeah.
What safety, when safety uses the word consult, it means tell.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean ask. Now, I'm not an engineer. And if I've got a problem around my house, like I had a couple of weeks ago, the plumbing problem, I call a plumber.
Yeah.
If I tried to fiddle it with myself, I turn a $5 job into a $5,000 job.
Yeah, you and me both, and mate.
I've learned early. Don't touch it.
Yeah.
You don't know. And so, for example, I've got several. I'm an older person. I've got several medical problems which I've had for quite some time. One I inherited from my father, and I've had 3 bouts of surgery in the last 9 months to work on this particular thing. Now, I completely trust the surgeon.
Yeah.
My surgeon is one of Australia, in fact, he's the world leader in addressing this particular esophageal problem I have. Now, what's interesting is the moment I go into his surgery and he starts talking, I don't understand a single word he's talking about.
Yeah.
But I have no choice but to throw my trust in him because I don't know.
Yeah.
So this is the problem about education for consultation. We tend to find, even within the Australian Institute of Health and Safety, we want to know something about ethics, we get a safety person to write it. You want to know something about English history, we get a safety person to do it. If you want to know something about psychology, we get a safety person to do it, and so on. It seems that safety thinks it can do everything when it can't do very much at all. And so if you were in the medical profession or the legal profession, the moment you get caught, you consult outside of your profession to others who are specialised. It's what joined me and a lawyer together, why we wrote a book together on due diligence. He doesn't know anything at all about what I do, and I know next to nothing about what he does. And so we came together to write about due diligence, and we prepare a lot together. But the problem of the, see, charity is also in dialectic with criticism. So if you chase the idea of charity, it goes all the way back to the Apostle Paul. Now, I don't want to bore you with theology, right? But the Apostle Paul wrote a book about charity to a church in Turkey that he criticized the living bejesus out of. He took them to shreds in various letters. So there was a huge city on the west coast of Turkey, and he wrote them a letter, and this is the word charity, where it came from. It actually means benevolence and kindness and love. That's what the word charity is interpreted. But if you go back to the source of it, the idea of loving someone doesn't actually mean blind compliance.
No, loving is telling them what they don't want to know as well as it is.
Yeah, that's correct. So for me, it's the balance. I'll offer criticism and I'll give you the balance to it, which is there is something better than that.
Mm.
You can keep doing engineering and science till the days come home, if you like. You can keep doing that. But there's a whole heap about that strategy, which we already know doesn't work. Why would you keep doing more of the same?
Yeah.
So I'll offer some criticism. But then I offer you help. There is a way forward. I would challenge you to sign up to a free course. I do free stuff because I'm retired. And so I get inundated with people who want to learn some of this practical stuff. And it's incredibly different. And so it's not as if one is without the other. Now, if I was just blindly critical without offering an alternative, then that would not be charitable. But I think sometimes it's like some people call it tough love. I don't like the word tough love, like I don't like the word soft. You referred to, you know, soft approach.
Yeah.
But there is no I don't like the language of soft and hard.
That makes it sound
like hard's better. I call them hard skills and people skills, not soft and hard. So the alternative to the hard approach, you know, the science, data, quantitative, counting stuff, is people stuff. It's not soft. It's actually just as tough and just as hard.
Yeah.
So somewhere along the line, we've got to reframe our language and get away from this bias towards the hard stuff. And that's the stuff I'm critical of, but I provide you with, in that form of communication, critical. But the alternative is there. Now, that's very, very similar to the Apostle Paul in the first century. He wrote to a bunch of Christians who were having sex in a cult with sons, with their mothers, right? So it was incest, right? So this was an early church in the first century practicing incense as part of their cult, and he ripped them to shreds and said, you shouldn't be having sex with your mother. Now, you could say that was aggressive.
That's a fair point.
But he provided them with an alternative and says, here's a more humanized way. Stop using your child as an object.
I think that's a really very fair return on that, Rob. And I would kind of echo that. That's something that we see a lack of, actually. We see a lot of criticism from other academics or other kind of thought leaders, but we don't see a lot of stuff, you know, especially for free. There's little for free. It normally sits behind a £600, you know, paywall to get to a workshop where we hear the same shit.
I love this latest 1% safer movement in Europe, where you pay €36,000 for a signed book and a lecture. Mm. Wow. Mm. Well, 6 of my books are free. I'm about to release a 7th one for free. This one here, the handbook, that's coming up for free because I'm celebrating in 2 more blogs. I'm celebrating 1,000 blogs. I've written 1,000 blogs in 10 years.
Oh, wow.
So that's 100 blogs a year, and there'll be another free book. There's lots of free videos, and now I have I've done for over 2 years now, since I turned 65, I've been offering free online courses. So there's no impediment for you to embrace the alternative. So, yes, I offer criticism, but don't shout that down and then say, oh, you don't have an alternative. Yes, I do. They're all there. It's free. It's available. It's your choice if you don't take it. But then your reverse criticism of my criticism is shallow.
Yeah.
And I don't know anyone in the risk and safety world that offers stuff for free that's constructive and practical. And there are countless people. In fact, the last blog I wrote offering the free course again, I put testimonies of people from the UK and Australia and Brazil in there of what they said they got out of the course.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I can do any more. And I understand, respect your criticism of aggressive and not charitable or not benevolent. And it is a dialectic. It is a difficult space to be.
Yeah.
You can be, you know, you can have a person on site who can be completely compliant. That's not what you want. Compliant people on site are not safe people.
Mm.
If all I do is blindly follow the advice given by the GM or the CEO and it's not contested, then no one learns. So there's if you're a good CEO, you have to invite critical contestation. And I'm happy to have the debate. That's why I'm here with you.
Mm.
If I didn't want the debate, I wouldn't be talking to you. But yeah. Let me tell you, I have never, apart from the one that you heard me on with
Nippon,
apart from Nippon, not one single person within that school of thought has ever wanted to have a chat.
Mm.
And I just mean a conversation.
Yeah.
So,
fair enough.
Well, I've tried pretty hard. I've tried hard, let me tell you. I don't want to embarrass the people who are involved in it, but I made some pretty significant efforts to build bridges with those people, and they're not interested.
Mm. I've one last question for you, Rob, before we kind of nip this in the bud. And it kind of came in my head as you were talking about your kind of using a medical profession, you use a medical profession quite a lot as a kind of good example of as a profession. When I kind of look at the medical profession, the amount of different careers and professionals or specialists within a medical profession, you probably couldn't count. Like, there's just that many of them, isn't there? You know,
it's whether about
you
2000. Got
it's unbelievable. It's about 2000. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. You don't have a medical professional. You have, you know, a series of different types of medical professionals. If you were to kind of dream the perfect example of a safety profession, would it actually, because we're based on generalists, like that's literally what we are based as. We are kind of jack of all trades, master of none. We're lawyers, we're engineers, we try to be psychologists, sociologists. Yeah, exactly. Would you, if you were to kind of redesign the safety profession, would you model it on that kind of model of the medical profession? And yes, you're a safety professional, but you're a kind of sociologist specialist within safety. You're a kind of safety psychologist, safety sociologist, safety engineer, safety lawyer, and so on, or risk lawyer, or whatever you want to call it.
If that was to happen, all of the associations on safety worldwide would have to disband and move away from engineering.
Oh, agreed.
The curriculum would need significant reform. Mm-hmm. A significant reform. If I look at, say, some of the professions I've been a part of in my career, let's take two: social work and school teaching. Both social work and school teaching are generalist professions. Within the education profession, there are as many professionals as there are doctors' professions, specialists within education. A school teacher is a generalist within a broad profession of education. So within that education sphere, you can get all sorts of specialities, not just school teaching. So within social work, it's quite similar. Within social work, you can get youth work, community work, prison work, and so on. I think safety is a long, long way about moving to that transdisciplinary approach. I think it's locked itself in, unfortunately, politically, over its short 60 years or 70 years of evolution. I mean, for quite some time, the American Association of Professionals used to be known as the American Association of Safety Engineers. Mm. They only changed their name 2 years ago. Same in Canada. They used to be known as safety engineers. Mm. And so that change has only come about, but nothing's changed. They've changed the name from engineer to professionals, but it's still engineering. Engineers. Yeah, it's still engineers. Mm. And whenever we have a major crisis here in Australia and it goes to court or there's an investigation. So, for example, there was a big theme park in Australia called Dream World up in Queensland where four people died in a rapid river ride.
Yeah.
And so this terrible situation, how four people were killed. Who did they call in? Safety people? No way. They called in 13 different kinds of engineer, one lawyer, and one behavioral psychologist. Safety people were banished. Mm. They're not lawyers, and they're not any of, they just don't fit.
Well, we're not even engineers. Like I
no, look you're at, not engineers either. Yeah, no.
I look at my educational route, and I can kind of see what, you know, many times, even now, what 10 years into my career within safety, I look at it and go, you know, really, what am I? Like, I'm not an engineer. I'm definitely not an engineer. Like, definitely not. Yeah. I'm definitely not a psychologist. I'm definitely not a sociologist. I'm kind of this weird mix of all of them. So you kind of sound like you're saying that there is a place for a generalist, but that generalist needs to be supported by specialists, and it's the specialists in which we lack within the safety profession.
It's both, but also I think safety would be much better off if it called itself a helping profession and got out of this idea that just being a generalist is enough. If you are a generalist and you are a helper, that is a very, very good position to have. One, you know your limitations. Hey, I'm just here to help. I'm not an expert. I can't cut you open and play with your brain. And I'm not an engineer. I can't tell you the stress on that bridge, or I can't tell you, you know, the perfect in and outs of some you know, complex system.
Like a GP. Kind of like
a
general
practitioner. Yeah, very much like a GP. And they know their limits. And so if I go to my GP and I say, I've got something, and then the doctor listens to me and says, you know what, here's a referral, off you go. Yeah. That's the role the generalist plays. But if you look at Inchpo's description of generalist and professional, it's gobbledygook. It's they merge the two together. They the only difference they can make between the professional, and they do this here in our association, is the practitioner and the professional are only separated marginally by the number of degrees they have. So it's a very messed up industry, and I've argued many, many times, look, what does an advisor really do? If I came on site and I saw my job is I'm just to help, I'm only here to help, and if I can't help, I won't do anything, right? I'm here to help. If safety took on that view, guess what? People would start liking them.
I think a lot of safety practitioners are starting to see that shift. Maybe there's a lag in the older side of the profession, and there's definitely a lag in our professional bodies. Like that, I think they like to communicate that as a headline, but I think we've seen in recent articles, for example, one on how to do an investigative interview or how to do that. That was not caring at all. That was
I ripped that one to shreds twice.
This is my point, Rob.
Maybe I was aggressive, eh?
All right, fair enough. I'll take that criticism. I think if you look at the output, Rob, of people that were so critical of that article, that is evidence that what you're doing is working. So, and that's my original point, in that I think sometimes you talk about safety as it, like, the majority of people are police officers and so on. Actually, I think it's shifting. I really think it's shifting.
Yes,
really
it is.
Fast.
It is. I'd agree with that. I guess if I had my biggest beef, it's with these IOSHers and Inchpos and associations.
You and me both, mate. Yeah, you and me
completely
both.
Completely politicized into a narrow financial band, because they're all struggling. They're losing members, bleeding out the back door.
Yeah.
People don't like that brand of safety anymore, but they don't know what to do. Yeah. The only thing they know that they shouldn't do is listen. That's the only thing they're convinced of doing, is don't listen to criticism. And because they're sealed within this kind of political fortress, it ends up fragmenting the sector, and they could easily take on that model that you suggested, like the general practitioner within the medical profession. They could easily take that on if they moved away from the mechanical to safety's about helping. Now, if safety's about helping, you've got to get rid of zero. And the reason why I left the association here is the day they went to zero, I left. You can't help anyone if your motto is zero. So there's the tension. So I would easily go back in the association if it was broad and got rid of this silly zero stuff, which is all about counting numbers. It's like, have we learned nothing? Counting injury rates is not helping anyone. Anyway, I've had my say. I've probably said too much.
No, that's the thing, Rob. Like I didn't know where this conversation was going to go today, but I knew we'd agree on a lot of the criticism that you have. Like I've spent the last year deeply within IOSH, but the year prior, volunteering, because I was so critical of them. And somebody said to me, "Hey, have you ever tried to change them?" I said, "No, fair enough. That's a good challenge. I haven't." So I volunteered for a year and I just got shut down. Like every time I wanted to say something, whenever we as a group wanted to, because I was part of a whole group of people that wanted to bring some significant change, there's just no appetite. They just shut us down.
I agree. They shut you down. They turn you into a political problem. That's worse.
Oh, yeah.
So, for example, in Australia, in our association, I had the highest rank. Well, they call it a chartered fellow, right? Mm. They made me a chartered fellow. If you offer any criticism, even as a chartered fellow, there's the door, leave. So when I criticise safety, there's a bit of a benchmark set by the orthodox associations. Mm. The funny thing is the only way to really move beyond that kind of this is safety is, in fact, to leave it and to subvert it. Hundreds and hundreds of people have come and study with me, don't belong to any of that stuff anymore. They don't recognize any identity to it. They don't see any of it helpful. They don't want to pay fees because they got nothing from their fee. They're not interested in the brand, so to speak. And so there's this whole movement of people leaving, but the orthodoxy, the traditional, it's not shifting at all. No shift at all.
No. It will it's like probably an oil tanker that doesn't want to turn.
Yeah. And often what happens over a period of time is someone will develop a subversive competitive association, which often happens a bit like in rugby league or rugby union or soccer. You know, if we don't like what FIFA's doing, well, we'll start up our own one and stuff you.
And
that kind of fragmentation actually helps in the end. And you find over time in history that they either re-emerge because they learn their lesson, or one fades out because no one wants anything to do with them anymore. Mm. And I don't know where that will go, but I don't think I'll be around to see it. Mm. But in the meantime, if I can be a bit of a troublemaker, I'm happy to be a bit of a troublemaker. Yeah. Because I'm inundated by the people who want to learn a different way of doing safety, to do it more humanely, more people-centered, more helping-centered. So I just concentrate on that.
I like that, Rob. And I will accept your earlier challenge and I will check out your free course. I'm gonna stab a guess. The time difference might keep me up at night.
But it's not too good. It's 9 a.m. that suits me on that would put you at 11 or 12 at night.
11,
But you can sign up and still watch the videos.
Oh, okay. So you can get it later on. You just can't do it live.
You can watch it later on, and little homework exercises. Do you get to go on site much? Like, do you go on work sites much at all in your job?
Yeah, not as much as I'd like at the moment, but yeah, definitely. So I'm the head of safety for a trade association. So we kind of try and guide members, and then so we go to their site and stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay. So you could watch it on video later. And then practice the tools on site, and then you could tell me whether they work or not.
Yeah. All right, mate. I'll accept your challenge.
Pleasure. And lovely to meet you, James.
Likewise. And I will hopefully do it again sometime. I think there's about a million different conversations we could have had within that one conversation.
I'm sure there is. Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Okay. Do you want to give a quick shout out? I know you've mentioned your free books, your free courses.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't.
How can people get that stuff? They're just going.
Well, they can jump online. They should just jump online and search Dr. Robert Long, or they can find it all the links through the RiskX blog site, or they can type in human dimensions. But you do any type in Google and put my name, and it'll jump up.
Yeah.
And again, just follow links. Free books, free videos, free courses, lots of stuff going. So I'm running a free course on ethics at the moment, and that's bang, it's going great.
Yeah, I think I know one of I run like a little mastermind community on the side, and one of our members is on your course, I believe.
Is that Sean? No, another one.
No, Graham Wales.
Oh, Graham. Wales. Yeah, yeah. He's up to his neck in it.
Yeah. No, he said it was good, actually. No, it's good.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent.
Nice one. Yeah, I've just gone on to humandimensions.com. I can see the books on there that are free.
And there's a link there to videos as well. Just follow the links. There's so much there.
Nice one. All right, buddy. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Good to meet you.
Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that conversation. We got into quite a lot of stuff there. I've had this one sitting behind the scenes for a long time, so I'm glad we can get this one out. Hope you enjoyed it. Let me know what you thought. Please do let me know what you thought. This is a big conversation space. Obviously, you know, we know if you know Dr. Rob Long, you know he's quite provocative in some of his posts and his blogs and so on. He's got a lot to say, and it's a very good conversation starter. So I'm really keen to know what you thought about our conversation, whether you agree, whether you disagree. I've definitely took a lot away from that chat that I've used actually going forward in my kind of work. So let me know what you thought. If you liked it, rate, review, share, whatever. We appreciate everything you do. Like, comment, dislike if you want. Whatever does, you know, every little helps. It all does help. So thank you very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. Hope you got some value out of it as well. Don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance HSE subscription service. And don't forget to check out Paradigm's Learning Organization webinar as well. You can get more details on their website below. Or if you want to contact them straight away, you can give them a call using the phone number below. And you can also email them if you want to using the email address below as well. If you want to find out more about what I'm doing, or you need to connect, LinkedIn, Twitter, everything's all in the description below. Don't forget to follow Rebranding Safety as well. LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, you know, we're there. You're going to get all the notifications and stuff, you know, it'll keep yourself updated. Or you can go to rebrandingsafety.com if you want to do some work with us. If you want to become a better safety professional, then check out projectmeletium.com. Website in the description below, because I can't be asked to spell meletium. But ultimately, I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.